At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economy is getting better. Let's say that right up front. There's growth. Consumers are feeling pretty good. What there isn't, though, is near enough jobs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 17th of March, and it is good to have you here, Irish or not. Let's pause for a brief economic review as a way to set up today's first story, shall we? We got some inflation data this morning. Core prices at the wholesale level, that's not counting food and energy, they held essentially steady last month. We'll get a reading on consumer prices tomorrow, also likely to be benign. The Fed says interest rates are going to be real low for the foreseeable future. Pretty much everybody agrees we are in an economic recovery. But Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York on yet another indicator that this particular one is jobless.
The Brookings Institution looked at the nation's 100 largest metropolitan areas and compared this recovery to the ones that followed the recessions of 1981, 1990, and 2001.
This recovery has been more jobless at the two-year mark than the recoveries from any of the last three recessions.
That's Brookings fellow Howard Weil, who wrote today's report. He says what's interesting is that U.S. metro areas are recovering at very different speeds.
Some places need a big economic stimulus. Some places need help with economic restructuring. And some places need only a tiny amount of assistance.
Among the worst-off locales are the Sun Belt states, whose economies benefit from vacationers and retirees. Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial. He says those areas are most affected by the housing bust, so they may sag for some time.
After every severe recession, there's always a whole lot of migration within the U.S. to where the jobs are. That's being hampered in this recovery by the fact that so many people have mortgages that are underwater.
So they may be trapped in a town with no jobs. Anne Owen is an economist at Hamilton College. She says some people are simply waiting for jobs that, because of the severity of this recession, aren't coming back.
Some jobs don't come back. And in the long run, that's actually a healthy thing for the economy because it pushes us into doing things more efficiently.
But in the short run, as many Americans already know, it's a painful process. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Hot on the heels of healthcare reform and financial reform, we now have education reform. Education Secretary Arne Duncan went up to Capitol Hill today to talk about overhauling No Child Left Behind. The Obama administration is going to do it with a $4 billion bump in federal education spending, a chunk of which is going to go to improving the nation's lowest performing schools. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Education Secretary Arne Duncan testified at back-to-back hearings today before the House and Senate Education Committees. He told the House committee, "We have to educate our way to a better economy."
27% of America's young people drop out of high school. That is economically unsustainable and morally unacceptable.
So the Obama administration has decided to focus on the lowest performing schools. And the new plan doesn't rely solely on test scores to measure success, like No Child Left Behind does. If a student doesn't test well but advances a grade, that's progress. Gary Huggins analyzes education reform at the Aspen Institute.
If someone takes a student, you know, a year and a half or 2 years worth of progress in a year, that's success. So in many ways, that's more fair.
The Obama administration is proposing $400 million in school turnaround grants, but the bottom 5% of schools wouldn't get any money unless they took drastic steps like firing teachers or converting to charters. Rebecca Kelly teaches fifth grade at an elementary school in Detroit. She says there are some things that teachers can't control.
You know, sleep, warmth, hunger, love. You can't learn unless all of those basic needs are met.
Kelly's school has pulled itself up and is now one of the top performers. But that only happened after it got a federal grant to buy food for students to take home. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hey man, what's not to like about low inflation? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The back-and-forth sniping between Washington and Beijing over China's currency policy continues after a U.S. congressional press conference on the topic yesterday. A key Chinese official responded this morning by saying that his government has become a convenient scapegoat for America's trade problems. Commentator David Frum says it's about darn time the U.S. said something.
Below the excitement over health care and financial reform, Congress has just delivered early notice of the top economic issue of the second half of this year. Trade. On Monday, 130 members of the House of Representatives signed a letter protesting China's manipulation of its currency to make Chinese goods seem cheaper. This helps China's exports and disadvantages U.S. competitors. In a more normal world, China's big trade surplus with the United States would lead to a big accumulation of dollars in Chinese banks. Directly or indirectly, the owners of those dollars would sooner or later spend them on American goods or services, correcting the trade imbalance. But it is not a normal situation. China acts to force the dollar's owners to leave them in banks controlled by the government. There, the dollars are used to purchase American debt, not American goods. That's not good for either country in the long run. But with millions of Chinese moving to the cities every year to look for work, China cannot worry about the long run. In the short run, it must create jobs for its urban millions. The undervaluation of China's currency creates those jobs, but at the expense of American workers. By one credible estimate, the manipulation has cost some 1.4 million American jobs. It would be illegal under World Trade Organization rules for China to directly subsidize exports. But China's currency shenanigans have the same effect. Back in the 1980s, the United States and Japan settled differences over currency reasonably amicably. But Japan is a friend and ally. China is something else. Never mind Israel-Palestine. The real test of President Obama's peacemaking leadership will be his ability to dispel the clouds of trade war now gathering over the Pacific Ocean.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Send us your thoughts. Online works best for us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Michelle Obama said something interesting today. The First Lady emphasized that her campaign against childhood obesity isn't so much about how the kids look. It's about whether they're getting enough good fuel for their bodies to be productive in school. Most kids get at least one meal a day actually at school. So sociologist Janet Poppendick spent some time trying to make sense of those meals, how and why they're served and prepared the way they are. Her new book about school nutrition programs is called Free for All. Janet, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Whatever happened to school food in this country? I mean, when I was a kid and when you were a kid, there was an actual lady in the lunchroom making lunches, serving it hot. It just doesn't happen that way anymore.
It started with the notorious Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1981, when the Reagan administration cut the subsidy for school meals by about a third. That was the subsidy that kept the price low for the paying children, the so-called full-price meals. It drove a lot of the paying youngsters out of the program, and that began to shift the image of the program toward being more a program for poor people.
Did that bring stigma with it, too? I mean, the fact
that... I would say it upped the stigma. It intensified the stigma. Kids sometimes refer to it as welfare food or county food. And as they grow older, they don't want to be seen eating it. Back to the financing issue, because I think it's really the key to understanding the answer to your question, what's happened to school food. In the early 80s, then, school food service directors found themselves confronted with a shrinking customer base. And they did what any business will do. They tried to find ways to produce the lunches more cheaply, and at the same time, they tried to find ways to market the foods to get those paying customers back into the cafeteria.
So how did they go about doing that? I mean, did they sit down and have a marketing meeting someplace?
Basically, what they began to do is they began to sell items a la carte that they knew students wanted to buy. So chips and nuggets and nachos and what have you became available in many, many schools, which kind of undermined the nutritional integrity of the program, but did generate revenues that subsidized the official meal.
It is, as we've mentioned, an enormous market, and companies that provide food to these 14,000 school districts across the country have an enormous incentive to get their products out there. Has the program been corrupted is kind of a strong word, but has it been bent a little bit by the influence of business?
Well, I think it's been bent by the efforts of school districts to comply with the nutrition standards. You know, it's kind of the letter of the law more than the spirit of the law. The spirit of the nutrition standards was, you know, we want to use this public investment to serve our children healthy meals. But the letter sometimes ends up with school districts purchasing products that have what's called a CN label, a child nutrition label, which certifies that they meet particular components of the menu planning standards. If they buy Smucker's Uncrustable sandwiches, they know that the ounces have been measured and it's going to meet school meal nutrition regulations. And if the state regulator comes in and finds out that it's short half an ounce of peanut butter, why then it's Smucker's that will be liable. And I think that interaction has resulted in products that probably neither you nor I would buy for our own family.
Jenna Popendick is a professor of sociology at Hunter College at the City University of New York. Her book about school lunches in America is called Free for All. Jenna, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
For all the focus on the food that goes onto school trays, there is more attention being paid now to the trays themselves. The hard plastic ones that most of us grew up with are largely a thing of the past, as Chicago Public Radio's Linda Lutton reports.
The students at Waters Elementary School in Chicago plant vegetables behind the school. They have compost bins and separate their lunchtime trash. So it's hard for children here to stomach the styrofoam trays lunch is served on. 9-year-old Alexander Conway is just a little taller than the garbage can where kids toss their trays.
And this is just going to the landfill. So we need to help our environment and get some like new plates and not these styrofoam.
Chicago schools use almost a quarter of a million polystyrene trays a day. The kids at Waters figured out that in a year, that's enough trays to pave a path to the moon. But tight school budgets make change unlikely. Here's school spokeswoman Monique Bond.
Everyone wants to do the right thing and have the healthiest choices, the healthiest environment for our students. But for us as a district, it all boils down to cost.
Schools can buy 500 foam trays for about $20. Biodegradable trays can cost four times that. Over the years, schools have gotten rid of hard plastic trays to save on labor costs. Many don't have dishwashers or drying racks anymore, so going back to the way things used to be isn't easy. But some districts are trying. Portland, Oregon is moving all its elementary schools to permanent wear.
The extra expense in paying for our employees to wash those trays will equate to a few $100,000.
Christy Obink is Nutrition Services Director at Portland Public Schools. Obink's budget allows for $2.70 per meal. That has to pay for everything from cheese pizza to employee benefits.
I have to make the really tough decisions as to whether or not to put the money into the food on the plate or put the money into washing the plates.
And like other school lunch programs across the country, Obink is expected to break even. In Chicago, I'm Linda Lutton for Marketplace.
Coming up, big business and social media.
Suddenly, people internally are really excited about it and see the possibilities. You know, we no longer have to educate and convince.
Tweet up, anyone? But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street danced a little Irish jig today. The Dow Industrials jumped 47 points, almost a half percent, ended at 10,733. The NASDAQ kicked up 11 points, also a half percent. Finish at 2389. The S&P 500 tapped up 6 points, about 0.6%, closed at 1166. Investors handed Massey Energy a four-leaf clover today. That after the coal mining company signaled it wasn't done acquiring smaller rivals, share sprouted 6%. Things were not so magically delicious for General Mills, the maker of Lucky Charms cereal. Shares wilted more than a 0.1%. Shares of Diageo, the company that brews, yes, Guinness, fizzled down nearly a half percent today. Over in Dublin, the ISEQ overall index rose about 2% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.64% back home. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Vanguard. Reacting to the stock market is investing. Taking stock in long term is vanguarding. More about vanguarding at vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases a consumer price index for February. The Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Financial Services and General Government discusses the financial health of the United States Postal Service. And anyone want to live forever? Irene Cara sung all about it in the hit song Fame. It's her birthday tomorrow. Internet sources say she's 51. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. My accountant called the other day, said the balance due on my Form 1040 come April the 15th isn't going to be as bad as I thought. But then he said we ought to do some planning for next year because taxes are surely going to go up. The Bush tax cuts are scheduled to expire. And besides, have you seen how much money the government is spending lately? That, as it happens, was the subject of David Leonhardt's column in the New York Times today, the curious connection between what taxpayers want and how much they're prepared to spend. David says that relationship hasn't always been as dysfunctional as it is today. A phenomenon, he says, is known as Wagner's Law.
The idea is that voters, as they get richer, as a society gets richer, and their basic needs are met, they tend to want things that government provides. They want a military to protect them. They want good schools for their kids. And so they vote for these things, and in order to pay for them, they also vote to tax themselves.
And that holds in societies, except for ours, it seems, the past couple of years. Our tax rates are actually going down, and yet we want the same stuff and more of it.
It's certainly held in the United States for a long time. Taxes made up about 2% of GDP at the beginning of the 20th century. And by the end of the 20th century, they were at 21 or 22% of GDP. You could imagine a society deciding to repeal Wagner's Law, as it were, and deciding, you know what, we want to do this all in the private sector. We don't want this stuff done by the government. And that might be fine. The problem is what we're doing, which is we're voting for these services, and yet we're not voting for the taxes to pay for them. And that, much more than the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, much more than the stimulus, is the reason we're facing this tremendous long-term budget deficit.
There are people out there, though, who say and have said on the record, you know, I would gladly be taxed more heavily if it worked, if more kids graduated from school, if malnutrition went away. But it never winds up translating into political decision-making.
One of the interesting things is when President Obama was Senator Obama and he was running for office, he persuaded voters that, in fact, he would do more to cut their taxes than his Republican opponent, John McCain. And politically, it worked. He succeeded. The polling showed he persuaded people of that. But it now has a huge political problem, which is he's made this pledge not to raise taxes on people making less than $250,000. So we have one party saying we won't raise your taxes if you make less than $250,000. And we have another party saying we won't raise your taxes no matter what. And we have neither party making proposals on big spending cuts. And that's how we've ended up where we've ended up.
The moral of the story, I guess, from your piece was that there's no one solution, right? You can't just fix everything by raising taxes, because that would clobber the economy and the tax rate here would be close to 50%. And you can't do it just by cutting social services, because that's not what modern American society is.
That's right. Paul Ryan, a Republican congressman, admirably has released a very detailed plan for getting rid of the budget deficit without raising taxes. It involves getting rid of Medicare for everybody who is now under the age of 55. And I don't think that's actually a society most voters want. And so what we're going to need to do is some mix of things. I think we do need to raise taxes on the rich. They've gotten the biggest pre-tax income gains and the biggest tax cuts over the last generation. I think we do need to introduce ideally something like a consumption tax on everybody, including the middle class, which would encourage people to save more. And I think we need to look at spending cuts. I think one of the reasons why this healthcare bill is actually important is because while it's far from ideal on healthcare spending, it includes some of the early ways to cut healthcare spending. That's why it tends to get a good score from the deficit analysts. And healthcare really is the number one budget item over the long term.
When, though, David, when do we do all this? Because clearly in the middle of or just coming out of a horrible recession is not the time anybody is going to take on these tough challenges.
I think it's probably going to take a little bit different moment in the political cycle. You can come up with a number of different scenarios. One involves the Republicans get control of one of the houses of Congress and become more willing to negotiate. The other is you have a president in the second term, whether it's President Obama or whether it's the next president, who's willing to do some things that are politically unpopular. But absent a crisis, I don't see it happening anytime in the next couple of years.
David Leonhardt, he's an economics columnist for the New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Okay, so here's a completely random but also somehow completely stunning internet statistic. The research firm Hitwise reported today that 14% of all internet visits last week went to just two sites. Google.com, of course, was one of them. Facebook.com was the other. It actually had more hits than Google did, by the way. So you know what that means, right? It's going to get even harder now to keep up with your Facebook page, to say nothing of your Twitter feed, your LinkedIn account, and all the rest of them. But if you think you're having social media management issues, consider for a second the internet plight of big companies, desperately trying to stay connected to their customers, whose main mode of communication is fast becoming social networking. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
At a Starbucks inside the Empire State Building, about a dozen people are seated at a table, sipping coffee and hunched over their smartphones. This is what's known as a tweet-up, a get-together set up on social networking site Twitter, in this case by Ford Motor Company. Ford truck owner Jack Monson came to the tweet-up. He's deep in conversation with the other people at the table, but nobody's actually talking.
Actually, we're sitting at the table, and I'm already in touch with them over Twitter. We've already shared a few photos of when some of the folks were speaking at the table and retweeted those photos. And we're actually talking about what the other folks at the table are talking about right now.
If that just blew your mind, don't worry. Most of corporate America has no idea what to make of it either. But more and more consumers are going to tweet-ups and Facebook pages and blogs to learn about products, so companies are scrambling to adjust, says Sam Ford. He researches social media at MIT.
Corporate America really hasn't completely caught on to how to deal with that yet. You're telling your story directly to the customer now. That changes the game completely.
On sites like Facebook and Twitter, companies have to respond to their customers directly and immediately. They also have to keep people interested with things like coupons or videos. If they succeed, the payoff can be big.
Okay, we're driving the Ford Fiesta around the country.
Ford recently launched a social networking campaign around the new Fiesta, which goes on sale later this year. Ford loaned Fiestas to young people all over the country and sent them out on adventures. Ford had them blog, shoot video, and post Twitter and Facebook updates.
We're going to tweet clues about what different cities we're in, and the first two people to find us, we're going to take them out to dinner.
The result? Thousands of Fiestas have been pre-ordered, sight unseen, and the car has better brand recognition than some Ford models that have been around for years. Scott Monty is the head of new media at Ford. He says it took a while to get the company up to speed. When he first asked Ford's CEO if he'd answer some questions on Twitter,
his immediate response was, sure, what's Twitter?
But Monty says with successes like the Fiesta campaign, everybody's interested in social media now.
Suddenly, people internally are really excited about it and see the possibilities. You know, we no longer have to educate and convince.
That's true at a lot of companies. And consultant Shell Holt says people with social media expertise are in demand.
If you look at position descriptions for companies that are hiring in their communications department, their marketing departments, they're all looking for social skills.
Or teaching them.
It's like my head is spinning because, I mean, I didn't even know what a blog was 5 years ago.
Brian Lusk manages communications at Southwest Airlines. He's worked there for 15 years. Lusk says social media requires transparency, which can be awkward. When filmmaker Kevin Smith was kicked off of a Southwest flight because he was considered too big for one seat, Southwest got hammered on Facebook, Twitter, and its own blog.
I think it shows this is a company that's gutsy enough to post these negative comments. So they're going to treat me right because they're not going to hide behind corporate speak.
Ford's Scott Monty says companies are still trying to deal with being so exposed, and they'll make mistakes. But the effort is crucial.
Well, we subscribe to the Woody Allen theory of social media. 90% of social media is just showing up.
But Monty jokes the other 10% is half the battle. If companies are smart with social media, they can build new types of relationships with consumers. And if they get it wrong, it's going to be all over Facebook. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. By Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, one that does not necessarily instill great hope that the Securities and Exchange Commission is right on top of things. SEC Chairwoman Mary Shapiro said this morning that after last week's revelations about Lehman Brothers cooking the books, it is safe to assume, she said, that her agency is looking closely at what other Wall Street firms were doing in the fall of 2008. Don't know if you saw it, by the way, but there was a story in the New York Times Monday about Lehman and the SEC. It said federal investigators were virtually living at Lehman Brothers for months before that bank went under. Somehow, they still missed it. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped up 47 points, almost 0.5%. The NASDAQ kicked up 11 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 stomped up 6 points, about 0.6%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this particular radio broadcast, how Google could change elections as we know them.
There are over 500,000 elected officials in the United States. We think that every single elected official could benefit from using Google AdWords to communicate with their voters.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.